Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm Eric, and I'm with my co-host Habanero.
Good morning.
And we have Jeremy Phillips with us today. Jeremy is an instructor of religion and humanities at Haywood Community College and the humanity instructor at UNC Asheville. Welcome. And I know you have a master's of divinity in theology and biblical studies. Did I miss anything?
That's my educational background for sure.
And what else can we talk about?
Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely.
Welcome, everybody.
We're excited to have you. You know, I wanted to start the show today with a couple news items and, anything you've seen lately that you want to talk about for the first couple minutes of the show. Anybody? Habanero?
I don't know. I heard some story about frogs.
Yes. Wow. Yes. Well, it's kind of a new study came out and I thought it was kind of funny. Because female frogs fake their own death in order to avoid mating advances for male frogs, according to the Royal Society of Open Sciences. And they escape their males by rotating their bodies, releasing calls, and faking their death. And I suppose that's not news to anybody who's a human.
I'm also, when we were talking about this before, it was funny that you said, I don't think women are going to be surprised by that. And I agreed with you 100%.
Right. So sometimes the obvious is fun. Even frogs are working on this.
I'm surprised they did a study on that.
On a more serious note, however, if you live in North Carolina, and most of our audience does, the Republican Party has released new legislative maps. And in the past, the maps were split up into seven Republican districts and six Democratic districts and one contested district. And the new proposals, option one is 11 Republican districts and three Democratic districts and no competitive, compared to another option, which is 10 Republican districts and three Democratic districts and one competitive district.
Shocking. Well, I find that to be shocking.
Tell all your friends that gerrymandering is not helping democracy. And I'm not going to say that the Democratic Party wouldn't do the same thing, but they're not doing it. The Republicans are. And it's a threat to democracy, in my humble opinion.
There used to be a walk you could take through Asheville when they cut Asheville in two. And you could actually walk the gerrymandered line through the city of Asheville.
Wow.
When was that?
That was I can't remember, 2010, okay. Somewhere in there. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Anyway, those are the news items for today. I asked Jeremy to come in. He's been on the show before, and it's always a pleasure. And we wanted to talk a little bit about the historical context for Judaism in Israeli politics. And is that going to be okay? Are we still on track for that?
Sure.
All right. So what did you think we were going to talk about? Does that sound good?
No, I'm just preparing myself.
All right. There's a little bit of an irony of violent response in religion. And one of the things we talked about as well was how to defend identity without crossing the line into oppression or even starting violence at all. So I wanted to start off with the historical roots of Jewish people's rationale and maybe talk a little bit about that.
Heavy stuff for the morning, for sure. And I'm sure many of us are looking at the news these days and seeing the, you know, increasing violence and in Gaza and in Israel and seeing the reaction, I guess, in the United States is also a lot of news. So one of the things that I've been thinking about, I guess, as a teacher in the humanities and as somebody who's helping students maybe understand what's going on in Israel right now is, thinking about the very, very deep and complex roots of this issue, right, and why this situation exists in the first place, right, with Israel and Gaza. And it's so complex. And I know we just have this morning to kind of talk about these things. And I don't think we want to go lightly into it either. It's people's lives are being lost daily right now, you know, over these issues. So very serious thing. So, yeah.
So help people understand the role of religion historically.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of times people have switched it over into politics. But what are the roots of this from a religious perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for a lot of Israelis who are religious, though many Israelis are very secular too, so... But it seems like right now, religious Israelis have had a lot of power in Israel right now and are really supporting the leader of Israel, Netanyahu, right now. So kind of his power base. So, you know, what Israelis who look back to this religious base, they look back to a history of, you know, thousands of years of a story that they've see themselves living in, a story of their God, their land, their law, and it's all tied in together very much with the idea of God giving their descendant Abraham a land and promising, you know, have descendants and have the in this particular place. And so Israelis have, or Jews, let's say, religious Jews, see this history as the rationale for why they should be in this place, you know, because it's, you know, God has given them this place. And that's just a very, and I've seen people say, you know, well, you know, just because it says in your old book of fables or whatever, that God gave you this place, that doesn't, you know, we have to deal with the current political realities. But I think for a lot of people, that's the number one reality that everything else is going to be subservient to. And what's also challenging in that story, I think, is the history of Israel is so complex, right? You have Israelites in the Bible, right? They get this land, they're kicked out of it, you know, I guess one time when they go to Egypt, they come back into it and they take it over, right? And they have these kingdoms, and then there's this exile. That when foreign conquerors come, and like in the Babylonian exile, you literally have the city of Jerusalem under siege by a foreign occupying power, laying siege to the city and forcing the people of Jerusalem to, you know, evacuate and get out. And I've been thinking of the parallels of some of these moments, but you have to today's events in Gaza. In a way, you have all these moments in Israel's history where they were the oppressed, the surrounded, you know, and then they're driven into exile, their temples destroyed, you know, they're pushed out of the land, and then there's political changes in the big wide world, and they get to come back, and they rebuild the temple, and they get back the land, but it's never the same, and then there's other foreign powers that come, like the Greeks, who... force them into, you know, similar situation where they can't practice their religion, and they're and then the Romans come and they basically destroy the nation, and they force them to, you know, out of the land again and destroy the temple again, 70 AD, right? And it's then this huge long story. And then in Europe, where you have pogroms and you know, serious oppression, where Jews are kind of the other in Europe, you know, them and maybe the Romani or something, you know, are the only other kind of outsiders of the nations of Europe throughout the whole Middle Ages, and they're the scapegoats, and there's, you know, all these stories leading up to the Holocaust, and so the Jews have this amazing story of being oppressed, and it's very real, and, you know, the horrors of the Holocaust are the culmination of that. And that's kind of always the justification for Jews then, you know, having the land of Israel, having this place now in this world, a safe place where they can be a nation and a people in this land again. Yet now the situation's reversed.
I definitely want to get to the reversal, but I also want to ask the question, one could argue that there are other groups, indigenous people, who also had land, mm-hmm. and maybe don't have the history of being, you know, given the land by a figure in the great text, but they did have the land and were pushed off of it. How would you respond if someone said, "Well, the earth is, there's one earth, we all share it. What is this business about having a parcel of land that's dedicated to you?" That seems like an interesting concept of being chosen to have a, No one else has a parcel of land that's been picked for them.
Yeah. Well, this is the essence of the problem, right? Is that when Jews didn't live in Israel, there were people who continued to live in that land for, you know, thousands of years, or, you know, since maybe 70 AD or whatever. And you have, and these are the Palestinians who have been living there for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, building their families, building their lives, having orchards and homesteads and histories in that place. And then so when in 1948 or 7, when the people start to come in, you know, Jews have the Holocaust as a rationale for being there. But then there's also a story of the Palestinians that when that happened, people came from outside, from their perspective, and forced them off of their lands, especially the really nice coastal plains where it's, you know, great agricultural land. So Jews came and they fought and they forced Palestinians out of their lands and homes and forced them into these areas, the West Bank and Gaza, basically, as refugees. And Palestinians call that the Nakba, the catastrophe. And so you have deep wounds on both sides, where both sides of this situation, people feel like victims.
They feel the same in many ways. They have probably a lot of shared trauma and ancestral trauma.
Yes, very much, very much.
Now let's go back to your irony of the situation. Two groups with shared trauma being pushed around. What's your take on this conflict?
The irony then is, you know, that Israel became so much more powerful than these groups in the West Bank and in Gaza, Palestinians. It's also important to say there are a lot of Arab, Palestinian, Muslim people who live in Israel too. So a lot of in like northern Israel, there are a lot of Palestinian people who live there. Like the city of Nazareth, for example, has, you know, huge like Palestinian population that's part of the state of Israel. But especially in these areas you have of West Bank and Gaza, it's just so, the living situations are so different.
Oppressive.
For the people who live there. And I got to see this in 2008. I went to Israel and the West Bank for like 3 weeks and traveled all through the West Bank and the city of Nablus and Ramallah and got to see what it's like for Palestinians living in those places. And it's really striking, especially when you compare to a city like, say, Tel Aviv or Haifa or something, which
is
beautiful city, beautiful modern metropolises, glitzy, you know, really nice places to live on the coast. And Palestinians live in kind of like an old world cities. There's bullet marks in some of the main squares. There's a lot of poverty. And Gazans especially have lived in poverty situations for a long time. And, you know, traveling through the area, you have to go through so many checkpoints along the way where the Israeli military is, you know, at these checkpoints all the time. So just to travel through the area, you're constantly reminded of who's in charge.
Right.
Well, and to get into a city like Nablus, which is a huge city, completely surrounded by, you know, barbed wire fencing, and, you know, you have to take all these taxi cab, little minivans, you pull up, and then you go through all these these fencing and these checkpoints to get into the city, which is completely encircled by wall. And then there's a whole bunch of taxis on the other side, which then take you wherever you need to go in the city. And, you know, imagine trying to do business. Like, I met a shoe salesman in the West Bank, and he was telling, you know, all his stories. And the other part of it that's really hard is for Palestinians seeing this all the time is you have Israel, let's call it the settler movement, right? So these are more religious Jews who feel the land should belong to them. And so they go into areas of the West Bank and take over a hilltop or whatever, and they stake out their claim and they begin living there and they start to build communities in the West Bank. So over time, more and more settlers have been taking more land in the West Bank. you know, this aggrieves the population, right. Let's say.
So I want to bring up a couple of things and then get back to this irony. And the first one is the more individuals speak like you, and I'll be honest, a lot of times I will go to TikTok to get information where you can get firsthand stories. The evidence is this is going on, that there is this oppression that's been going on. I think the American mainstream media has been dragged kicking and screaming into this discussion. I think it was at first it was just a terrorist attack, and then it was like, oh, well, there is a humanitarian crisis. As more voices in the region said, this is a real humanitarian crisis. Yeah. So now that brings us back to this idea of oppression, a victim who's had trauma, and I'm talking about, you know, the Israeli people or the Jewish people, and now it's clear that oppression has been going on. What are we to do with this idea of going from victim to oppressor?
It seems really hard for a people like Jews to kind of deal with that, because the story has always been not being the oppressor, right? And there's a really long history of serious oppression in
absolutely
for sure. And how to own that?
Well, one of the things we talked
really is just really challenging.
Well, one of the things we talked about is this idea of identity.
Yeah.
And there is a Jewish identity, there's a Palestinian identity, and there's that identity is shaken and challenged when you're oppressed, when you're exterminated in concentration camps, you're pushed off the land. For the people in Palestine, you're put in this, what they call an open-air prison. So there's this attack on your identity. Mm-hmm. And so how do you preserve your identity? Anyone, this is just an example to me. How do you preserve your identity without becoming violent?
One way, and you know, it's so complicated and the wounds are so deep, it's hard to get to these places. But what's great about these traditions like Judaism and Islam is that you have deep reserves within these traditions for mercy, for taking care of the widows and orphans in the tradition of Judaism, for example, of justice. You know, the incredible prophetic tradition that exists in Judaism is very much that you are to live well. You are to treat other people with kindness and goodness and love the foreigner in your midst. In a way, this is what got Israel, according to the tradition of Judaism and the prophetic tradition, this is what caused like the exile, you know, that you weren't meeting these conditions of their covenantal relationship with God. You know, it's not a one-sided thing like, you know, God saying, I will always give you all the blessings forever, no matter what. It was kind of like, I'll be your God, you'll be my people, and you need to be this kind of people who love widows and orphans and the foreigner in your midst, and, you know, and keep my laws, which are about justice and et cetera. Right?
Right.
So you have that tradition of within Judaism of saying, love your neighbor, right? Show kindness. And same in Islam, you have, you know, lots of, you know, messages within Islam about peace. Islam means peace, basically. It comes from the word salam. And so how do you get to that place where you're choosing the best parts of your religious tradition to motivate you rather than these parts which are about retributive justice?
Well,
it's really challenging.
It is challenging.
And there are a lot of people who do. A lot of people who do live according to those things and believe them and are not the ones, you know, shouting for the destruction of Gaza right now. Those voices exist.
Or the ones who are advocating for the destruction of Israel.
Exactly. Within the Palestinian community, there are very nonviolent movements, which, and this is what kind of has been going on for a long time, and they weren't getting anywhere with the current movement of the Israeli government, and maybe and conditions had been getting worse. So
yeah, it's been described as an apartheid state in there.
Yeah, and
restricted movement, restricted access to necessary supplies for living, food, water being cut off. If you really listen to some of the stories, what's happened to the Palestinians has been pretty bad.
It just feels like we need a reset. It is hard, but that means that probably violence is easy because it's a base, it's almost like a base instinct. And keeping the peace, it's a shame that this was never started a long time ago, because originally it should have been, can we work together, instead of this, we're taking it back. We're taking the land back, or we're going to fight for the land, and or we're going to kill all the Jews. It became this either or scenario. And, you know, these lessons to me, these lessons about peace have been taught since the beginning of time on some level. And it is a consistent recurring theme that the answer to that is always violence. It's when you're a victim, you turn to violence. When you're going through a difficult economic crisis, you turn to violence, you blame someone else, and it becomes war. And
cycles.
It does, and it's sad, and it cycles. And, you know, the intent of this conversation was not to solve it, because it's just to have a different perspective on it, to get people thinking, you know, why is violence so easy? And from a historical perspective, a religious perspective, it has roots in being peaceful.
Someone was talking about Martin Luther King and the I Have a Dream speech. And I listened to the speech yesterday, at least a segment of it. And there's a line in the speech where he says he has a dream that the children of slaveholders will live in peace and friendship with the children of slaves, right? If you probably remember right. that line. And my mind went immediately to, you know, the children of Hamas and the children of, you know, contemporary Israelis or settlers, let's say, right? You know, can that dream exist? And, you know, I was thinking Martin Luther King was saying that nearly 400 years after slavery began, and, you know, 100 years after slavery had been abolished, you know, and still having that dream, but having it not be a reality, and how much more violent is the situation in Israel and Palestine, you know, with like war and murder and just, and yes, that was happening in the United States in a major way. And yes, there was the Civil War, and maybe it's very similar actually, you know, but just that, well, like, how long does it take?
Right. Well, that's the question for me. It's
people to kind of even get to that point where we're dreaming of the children of the current combatants.
Instead of dreaming, we should probably start doing.
You know, that what you just brought up is a little bit of what we've been talking about before. It's the idea of othering, and it happens everywhere, right? In high school sports with, you know, the team in the next town over that you're a football rival with, or maybe you get to college and there's still that kind of rivalry, or, you know, families or neighbors. I think it's that concept of othering that we've been talking about today is common everywhere. And you know, what do we do to change that, not only in ourselves, but how do we help our children not grow up with that?
Boosting cognitive empathy, trying to, you know, see somebody else as somebody like you, you know, a human being who has the same cares and concerns. And the more dignity that we give to other people, I think that's a great definition of progress.
That's a great thing to build on, this idea of not othering and to treat people with dignity. And when we talk about the conflict in Gaza, you know, what are some of the things that you, during this conversation, have learned or thought about and would want to share with folks to go forward?
I'd say hope for that particular conflict has to come out of that, where people are really seeing other people as real human beings, not as human animals, or different quotes that have been going back and forth, or seeing people as worthless, right? And having no value, right? And that's got to be a key in this situation. And getting away from that us and them thinking, or Jew and Gentile, or, you know, Muslim and everybody else, or whatever it is, you know, realizing, and these are foundational things for all of those religious traditions, really deeply, especially these Abrahamic traditions, where they go back to, you know, we're all the, you know, created beings from some God. Finding there's so much possibility for unity if we can get that cognitive empathy. I think, you know, trying to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, what would it be like for you to be there?
I know for me, one of the things that was so discouraging for me was to see how many people in my circle, pretty wide and varied circles all over the place, were so immediately quick to jump and take a side and start vilifying themselves without understanding anything, without looking into it. It was like they saw something on television or they heard something on the radio. All of a sudden, they're ready to get out their pitchfork and take a side and call for the crucifixion of, you know, one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And as Eric had said before, when you really start to, and Jeremy, as of you've been saying, when you really take the time to learn a little bit and get some of the history and understand what's going on or what has happened, you know, you get to see a different picture, and maybe that's where some of that cognitive empathy can come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trying to see the world from somebody else's perspective. What do you see when you look out and see these situations? Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think it's really important, and I know we were kind of kidding around at the beginning of the show, but I'll go back to this idea of what's going on with gerrymandering. It's this idea of excluding others as well. It's the cognitive empathy goes away and says, I don't want to live with this other. And whether I'm going to do it through political means in gerrymandering, which is just going to create more conflict. It's just going to create more frustration. And again, that's just a small nonviolent piece. And then you have the same idea of not having cognitive empathy in a situation that's been going on for centuries or decades, depending on your perspective, in the Middle East. And, you know, if there's one thing that I just think we keep coming back to is, I love the idea of cognitive empathy, but it's the same idea of we rush to either or and whataboutism and just this idea of someone else is doing it. It's almost like children. Well, she started it, you know, kind of thing, or he did this first. And it's just like, okay, really? That's what we're left with. And it's kind of demoralizing because we all know better and we keep falling into this trap. And, you know, when you go back to the religious roots of things, we know better and we've been taught differently. And yet we still wind up in this place where we want to exclude some groups. We want to now harm some groups and we dehumanize them, calling them dogs or whatever it is. You know, I think the path forward is to embrace diversity. Jeremy, thank you very much. We've got to run, but it's been great. It's been enlightening. Habanero, as always, it's a pleasure. Have a great day.
Who come finally at retirement age and say, now I can be the best potter, jewelry maker, best whatever, ever. And it's their turn. But it sounds like most of you have been in it for life, so to speak. And I'm not one for real lengthy introductions. We'll just rather draw some conversation from some of the material. But I think that, to me, again, as I mentioned before, that Penland is really, to me, a stamp of approval, because it ain't easy getting in there. So, and if you have phones on like I do, you got to turn them off. I can't talk right now. Who is this? Hello? Hello? Yeah, I'm going to remind myself to turn my phone down. Habanero, are we on air yet?